Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter and Anna Mateo. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will present America's Presidents. But first, here is Mario Ritter.
A new study shows that the Japanese nuclear industry is unlikely to reach a government target of providing at least 20% of the country's energy by 2030. The study was prepared for the Reuters news agency. In Japan, 8 nuclear power centers are currently producing electricity. Another is expected to start operating this month. That means nuclear centers are set to provide more electricity this year than any other form of renewable energy except for hydroelectric power. It will be the first time Japan's nuclear industry has produced that much electricity since 2011. That was the year when an earthquake and tsunami destroyed part of the Fukushima Power Center in eastern Japan. After that disaster, all of the country's nuclear power centers were ordered closed. Researchers say as few as 6 nuclear power centers are likely to restart production in the next 5 years. That is likely to result in fewer than the 30 power centers needed to reach the government's goal by 2030. Reuters noted that, based on its research, Japan may get 15% of its electricity from nuclear energy by 2030. It's impossible to meet the target. That's pretty much confirmed, said Takeo Kikawa, an energy studies professor at the Tokyo University of Science. He was part of a group that studied Japan's energy policy earlier this year. Kikawa said that he did not expect other nuclear reactors to restart operations before 2020. Japan's Nuclear Regulation Authority created new safety rules after the Fukushima disaster. All nuclear reactors had to receive new operating permits before restarting. But the recovery has been slow. Before the disaster, Japan had 54 reactors, which provided 30% of the country's electricity. At that time, Japan had the third largest number of reactors in the world. But the return of nuclear energy in Japan has been uneven and may be based on the technology used. Kansai Electric Power and Kyushu Electric Power have won approval or are set to receive permits to restart all of their reactors. Those reactors use pressurized water to create electricity. All are far away from Tokyo, home to over 9 million people. In eastern Japan, boiling water reactor, or BWR technology is used to produce electricity. Japanese courts are hearing many cases involving nuclear reactors in the eastern part of the country. In addition, government regulators are disputing risk levels with power plant operators. The older BWR technology is being reconsidered because it was used at Fukushima. Nobuo Tanaka is chairman of the Sasakawa Peace Foundation. He served as head of the International Energy Agency from 2007 to 2011. Tanaka notes that reactor design has become a political issue. When you come to the BWRs, the issue becomes very politicized, he said. He added that the public image of another major electricity provider, TEPCO, has been harmed. TEPCO operates two nuclear plants that have been damaged in natural disasters. Tanaka said TEPCO does not have any support as a nuclear operator. TEPCO has reached the first level in the approval process for some of its plants, but it faces local opposition. However, supporters of Japan's power industry point to progress. Satoru Katsuno is chairman of a group representing electric utilities in Japan. He said that approval of pressurized water reactors takes time. He noted there also are developments with boiling water reactors. Katsuno is president of the utility Chubu Electric. His company has been locked in a dispute with regulators over its Hamaoka Nuclear Energy Center on Japan's east coast, which uses the older technology. For now, many experts believe that Japan will depend on fossil fuels such as liquefied natural gas and coal for a large part of its energy production. That could be needed as the growth of solar, wind, and hydropower energy slows. However, that will make meeting international agreements to cut carbon dioxide gases more difficult for the country. In the last 6 years, Japan has had to buy fuel to replace the energy that would have been created by nuclear reactors. Most of that fuel has been liquefied natural gas. The government estimates that the electricity industry has had to spend $130 billion for fuel during that period. Utility industry officials say the lack of realistic energy goals makes it difficult to invest for the future. And concerns over the ability of power stations to survive natural disasters are strengthened with each new event. I'm Mario Ritter.
From VOA, Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. They are the world's smallest human beings. A premature baby is born too early, before 37 weeks of pregnancy. A micropreemie is born even earlier, spending less than 26 weeks inside the mother. A pregnancy normally lasts about 40 weeks. Some of the smallest premature babies weigh less than 1,500 grams. And these micropreemies need every gram of weight they have. When Vanessa O'Hockham gave birth to her son, she was only 24 weeks pregnant, and she was frightened. Her newborn son, JC, weighed just a little more than 736 grams.
I couldn't even change his diaper. I was so nervous and anxious. He just looked so frail. But the nurses were very supportive and encouraging.
JC's low birth weight placed him among the very smallest of premature babies. Doctors say he needed special medical attention 24 hours a day in a hospital's neonatal intensive care unit, called NICU for short. But JC was lucky. He was a patient at Children's National Medical Center in Washington, D.C. A team of specialists there has come up with a nutrition plan to give micropreemies the best chance to live and grow strong. The newborn was also part of a nutritional study of micropreemies. The hospital's NICU had a team of specialists from different healthcare fields. It included doctors specializing in neonatal care, nutritionists, and breastfeeding specialists. Their goal was to increase the weight of preterm babies and improve their chances of survival. Because they are born so soon, premature babies can have many developmental issues and health problems. Micropreemies can have even more. Their organs are not fully developed, and they are not able to breastfeed. So helping them to eat and gain weight is most important. The team looked at what and when the babies ate. Caitlin Forsyth is the lead nurse who watched over the premature babies in the study. She said the best thing for them is to have mother's milk.
That is what's best for the premature babies. They tolerate it better, has great antibodies.
She said one goal of the study was to standardize the feeding process for the micropreemies. Whenever possible, Forsyth said, the babies were fed mother's milk, but not just breast milk. They were given enriched, donated breast milk, since not all the mothers could provide their own. The micropreemies were also given enriched milk and formula. Forsyth told VOA that she is pleased with the results.
We have been able to put protocols in place so that there's a standardization of care. We've also increased the amount of mother's own milk we've been providing for the babies, which is great.
Also on the team was a breastfeeding expert. Judy Campbell helps new mothers feed their babies, should they run into trouble. She knows the value of breast milk.
We know that mother's milk has growth factors in it, can't be replaced with any other substance.
The healthcare administrator who led the team is Micheland Ridore. She notes that micropreemies have little body fat and have no energy to waste. So, she explains, the team kept the babies in incubators, which provides a controlled environment. This keeps them warm and helps them to sleep better. As a result, they are less likely to move around and burn calories. Ridore says there was a big improvement in the ability of the babies to grow and gain much-needed weight.
Preemies in particular have poor development. We were able to improve their weight by 30%.
The team has not yet published a report on the study. However, Ridore presented the findings at the Virginia Neonatal Nutrition Association Conference in September 2018. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Jimmy Carter. His given name was James, but he liked to be called Jimmy. Carter was elected president in 1976. Until he campaigned for the office, few Americans knew who he was. But Carter said his lack of experience with the federal government made him the best candidate. After witnessing years of problems in the White House, many voters appeared to agree with him. However, Carter's inexperience also became a problem. Some of the issues he faced were complex, and at times, they seemed overwhelming. After only one term, Carter failed to get reelected. But in time, his public image improved. His years after leaving the White House are generally considered more successful than his time in office. Jimmy Carter was born in the southern state of Georgia. He was the oldest of four children. His father was a businessman. His mother was a nurse. The family owned a store, as well as a peanut farm and warehouse. Although the businesses did well, Jimmy Carter grew up very modestly. His family's house did not have electricity or running water. But he was hardworking and wanted to be successful. As a boy, he saved enough money to buy four houses. He earned more money by renting them to other people. He also decided to attend college at the United States Naval Academy, and in time, he did so. Carter was an excellent student, and he became a fine naval officer. As a midshipman, Carter worked on one of the country's first nuclear submarines. He later taught nuclear engineering to other crew members. But Carter's promising career in the Navy ended after only 7 years. His father was dying, and the family farm was in trouble. Carter, his wife, Rosalyn, and their three sons decided to return to Georgia and try to save it. The first years back on the farm were difficult, but in time, the business became successful again. Carter began to turn his attention to other issues. He became involved in his church, local school, hospitals, and libraries. When he had a chance to compete for a position in the state Senate, he took it. As a politician, Carter developed an image as an independent thinker who tried to save the government money. He also acted and spoke strongly against racial discrimination. In Georgia at the time, many voters did not agree with Carter's support of racial equality. In 1966, even his own Democratic Party did not choose him to be its candidate to represent Georgia in the U.S. Senate. So Carter began campaigning for the office of state governor instead. In 1970, he was elected. As Georgia's governor, Carter was known as a social and political reformer. However, historian Robert Strong notes that Carter did not always work well with others in his party. Strong teaches at Washington and Lee University in Lexington, Virginia. He writes that some Georgia lawmakers believed Carter was arrogant. He could appear to think he was morally right, and they were morally wrong. Carter's difficulty in getting along with other officials proved to be one of the problems he would later face. But in the presidential election of 1976, many Americans seemed to like this quality. The little-known governor from Georgia defeated the sitting president, Gerald Ford. Carter won, in part, by saying that he was different than other politicians. He was, he said, a Washington outsider. Then suddenly, Carter was the biggest insider of all, the American president. One of the things Carter wanted to do was change the image of the president. Earlier leaders, such as Richard Nixon and Lyndon Johnson, had increased the power of the presidency. Nixon had also been shown to be dishonest and resigned from office. Carter promised never to lie to the American people, and on the day of his swearing in as president, he purposefully tried to keep things simple. He walked to the White House from the U.S. Capitol building instead of riding in the back of an automobile. His wife wore clothes that she had worn in public before. The National First Ladies Library notes that her choice of clothing sent a message of an old American value of thrift or respecting money and not spending it needlessly. What she wore was meaningful because the country was going through difficult economic times. The Carters wanted to show that the new government would work to cut costs. They also wanted to show that they were there to help the American people, not enjoy the powers of the White House. But in the end, the Carter administration received poor ratings in surveys of public opinion. President Carter had trouble dealing with U.S. lawmakers, even when his party was in control of Congress. One result was that Carter could not advance many of his ideas for legislation. He appeared ineffective. Many historians point out that, in fact, Carter had a number of successes. He helped reduce the country's dependence on foreign oil. He took steps to make the federal government more efficient and to improve the environment. He appointed a number of women and racial minorities to top government jobs, an important move at a time when many were pressing for women's rights and civil rights. And in many cases, Carter supported human rights causes, both in the United States and around the world. But the public generally did not see Carter for his successes. Instead, many Americans blamed him for the country's economic problems. Some also disliked the way he spoke to them. In one speech, Carter blamed the country's troubles on what he called a crisis of confidence. Some listeners were offended. He also decided that the U.S. would not attend the 1980 Olympic Games in Moscow. The move was meant to punish the Soviet Union for its involvement in Afghanistan, but many Americans believed the move mostly hurt young American Olympians. The administration also faced other problems. The president was never accused of wrongdoing, but other high-level officials were. So was the president's brother, Billy. As a result, Jimmy Carter's public image for honesty suffered. Then came the Iran hostage crisis. The conflict between the United States and Iran had a long history. One part involved the Shah of Iran. The U.S. government had supported his rise to power, partly because American interests wanted to control Iran's oil. But the Shah severely abused his power. Many Iranians resisted. Some wanted a leader who would more closely obey Islamic teachings. In 1979, under pressure from those Iranians and others, the Shah fled the country. By now, he was suffering from cancer. So, as a humanitarian act, President Carter permitted the Shah to come to the United States for medical treatment. The move made Iranians angry. In protest, a group of students seized the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, the capital of Iran. They took 90 people, including 66 Americans, hostage. Carter worked hard to get the hostages released. He tried diplomatic negotiations and economic restrictions, but his efforts did not work. Finally, he tried a secret military operation. He sent 8 helicopters and a team of special forces to enter the embassy and rescue the hostages. But that operation failed too. The weather was bad. 3 of the helicopters crashed. 8 Americans were killed. And the public's approval of Jimmy Carter dropped even more. After 444 days, the remaining hostages were released. In exchange, the U.S. government agreed to end some of its economic sanctions against Iran and promised not to interfere in the country's affairs. None of the hostages had been seriously hurt, but the crisis was the final blow to Carter's presidency. A few months before they were released, his effort to seek re-election failed. As president, Carter did not meet the high expectations he had set for himself, and he faced some unusually difficult situations. His presidency also suffered from his problems communicating effectively with Congress, the media, and the American people. But his 4 years as president did leave several marks on the office. For one, he showed that the U.S. president could help other nations and sides resolve their disputes. Carter's best-known success as president was his help negotiating the Camp David Accords. The Accords were a peace agreement between Egypt and Israel. Carter led the talks at Camp David in Maryland. Carter's efforts to protect human rights overseas also influenced the foreign policy of later presidents. In time, his work as a defender of human rights has become his most important legacy. Several years after leaving the presidency, he founded the Carter Presidential Center at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. The center seeks to prevent and resolve conflicts, enhance freedom and democracy, and improve health. In addition to his work there, Carter has helped build houses for people who need them, written books, and negotiated with world leaders to take steps toward peace. In 2002, Carter received the Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.